Joy is the first glimpse of blue sky peeking through the overcast of a late winter day. Joy is the first brave tulip of the season, the first harvest of fresh blueberries, all the little pops of color to remind you that spring is on its way. New Yorkers know this better than anyone. It's time to bring the spring back into your wardrobe, and nothing says New York spring like Kate Spade New York. Their new spring collection is perfect for all your adventures, day or night. Discover and shop the spring collection at Kate Spade New York.
Welcome to The Cut on Tuesdays on Thursdays. I'm Stella Bugby, editor-in-chief of The Cut. This is How I Get It Done, The Cut series about ambitious women and the way they live. How they deal with their inboxes, people's feelings, their grocery shopping, their morning routines. It's part advice column, part love letter, part voyeurism. This week, I spoke with Nora McInerney, the author of No Happy Endings and It's Okay to Laugh, Crying is Cool Too, and The Hot Young Widows Club. She also hosts a podcast called Terrible, Thanks for Asking. You may notice a theme.
I'm kind of a tragedy connoisseur a little bit, and that is because in 2014, my husband Aaron died of brain cancer, and he died 6 weeks after my dad died of cancer, and my dad died 5 days after I lost my second pregnancy. So, I'm fun.
Nora was left with the son she'd had with her husband Aaron a year and a half before he passed away. Within 2 years, she'd written her books and started her podcast, but during that time, she had to figure out how to live her life while grieving. In the first episode of her podcast, she says, grief isn't just crying. Not just a facial expression. A grieving person can do a lot of things like laugh and go to the movies and go to the grocery shop and raise a child. But Nora told me another thing someone can do while grieving. Go out to dinner with men.
I was 31. I was a mom. I spent all my time like trying to survive and having a child like with me at all times and just to be at dinner with somebody. And it was so intoxicating to just be around a man, even one that I wasn't physically attracted to, but who would like pull my chair out and like pay for dinner and buy me a drink, that I just was so starved for it because it's so hard. Like skin hunger is a thing, like that need to be touched. People need that. And I for sure had that. I would like hug my friends' husbands and be like, sorry, I'm not letting go. Like, sorry, this feels way better than I thought it would.
Nora has written about how right after her husband died, it actually wasn't hard to get things done. Shopping for a funeral dress wasn't a problem, for instance. Sadness, anger, grief, they were manageable at the beginning. But then, she says, they stopped being manageable.
At some point, your brain sort of unwraps all of those feelings and hands them to you at really inopportune times. And I would be somewhere completely unemotional, and someone would ask me something, and it would hit me as if I were hearing it for the first time, and I would basically just start crying and be like, oh my God, my husband's dead. And the person would be like, ma'am, this is Starbucks. We need you to just go. We just need your order and your first name. That's it. That's all we need.
Wait, so back up for 1 second. When did you find out that he was dying?
We knew that he had a brain tumor on October 31st, 2011, and we had been dating for a year, and he had a seizure at work, and I went to the ER, and we both were like, oh, weird. It just did not seem that serious, and they had put him through an MRI, and they told us that night that he had a brain tumor, and I looked at him. We were laying in his hospital bed, and I was like, you're marrying me now. And he was like, you can't marry someone who has a brain tumor. And I was like, oh, I will. And we will be married immediately. It was very romantic. And I remember, you know, his mom saying to me, like, are you sure? It could get really bad. And I was like, yeah. And that's kind of the point, right? Of being married, like good things and bad things.
Seems like maybe you jump into love really fast. Like you met this man, you find out this very upsetting news about him, and your reaction is, we're going to get married.
I think I'm a decisive. I think I'm a decisive person. Also, it's like I'm in the Midwest. I was 27. That's like old maid status here. But I had also done my fair share of not falling in love, if you know what I mean. Like there's the world is littered with men I didn't marry. It was just pretty evident right at the beginning. Like, oh, like this is like we just fit.
So you guys find out he has a brain tumor, and then you decide you're going to have a child, knowing that he is about to face all these medical traumas?
We knew that he had stage 4 brain cancer. We knew that that was incurable. And so before he had started chemo and radiation, like, you know, we had like 2 weeks and he went to I don't know what they call it technically, but basically a place where you store your sperm, and he did the sperm storage. And you need a lot more than you think you do. I don't know that right away we're like, yeah, you know, we definitely should have kids. But we went to Disney World with his niece and nephew. And the first night we were there, I was like, do you want kids? And he was like, yeah, I really do. And I also am so afraid that I would leave you alone with them. And I told him, I can do that. Like, what a liar I was to have told him I would be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reality of it was, oh my God, how would I possibly do this alone? Like, how would I do any of it alone?
Take me back to that pregnancy. You are experiencing the first time of changing your own body, and Aaron is undergoing chemo at the same time. Is that,
yeah,
I heard
it
that
was,
right?
Yeah, he was still going through chemo when I was pregnant, and when I was about 8 months pregnant, right before I had Ralph, we went to his, you know, every 6 weeks he would get an MRI and they would look at his brain and say, oh, no, it's the brain tumor is not growing, it's not back. Or they would, you know, this one time, they said it's back, it's growing, and it's grown, you know, a lot. Since the last time we saw you, there's nothing, and now there's something. And so we have to take care of it right away. And I was weeks away from having our baby. And Aaron's treatment changed immediately. He had brain surgery a month before Ralph was born. And then his chemo switched from being something, you know, it was just pills he took at home, to being something where he was checked into the hospital for 3 days at a time. But I do remember him going into that brain surgery on December 26th, and my due date was the 22nd of January, which is also when Ralph was born, and just thinking, yeah, he might not be here for any of it.
Since this is called How I Get It Done, this podcast, in that year after all this trauma and you have a newborn, you're at home, are you working? What were you doing?
Yeah, I was working like all the time. I feel like the year after, I just felt like I have to do everything. I wrote a book, my first book, It's Okay to Laugh. I pitched this podcast that I have. I traveled all the time. I would go wherever I had a friend where I could stay for free. And Ralph and I would only buy one-way tickets so that I didn't have to commit to coming back to Minnesota.
Wow.
And I did freelance copywriting. I was just trying to cobble together a living and just stay in motion so that this crushing reality couldn't catch me.
Were you able to do anything nice for yourself during those, you know, first 2 years?
I did so many things that were not super nice to myself. Like, I drank a ton, like a lot, like all the time. And I spent so much money that I didn't have. If I wanted something, I was like, I'm going to get it. My husband's dead. Try to correct my behavior. You know, I really tried to look good every day. That was kind of my thing. I was like, well, if anyone sees me, I don't want them to feel sorry for me. So I'm going to have makeup on. I'm going to have red lipstick on. I will always be dressed. I will always look good.
And I think you actually formed a club, right? Called the Hot Young Widows Club.
Yes. Yes, the Hot Young Widows Club. At first, it was like 30 people in a Facebook group. And now it's like 3,000 people are 4,000 people in an online community, and it grows every day because people keep dying. And it's just like us. It's just a safe space to grieve and to not be told what you should be doing. You know, like, oh, you should be grateful that you had him. You should be glad that you fell in love.
Yeah.
Like, you should think, you know, look on the bright side, be happy. And so we don't do that, which is really important. And I had thought that I didn't need anything or anyone that first year. I didn't go to therapy. I was like, what are they going to tell me? I'm sad. And no, it was actually really great once I went to therapy. I was like, oh my gosh, this is very valuable. Oh, medication? Yeah, probably need it. Truly, all of these things, like the actual work of living, is self-care. It's not all like meditation. It's taking the time to book yourself an appointment with a doctor who can refer you to a therapist that she thinks would be a good fit. And then making sure you actually keep that appointment. That is not easily celebrated on Instagram, but it's so important.
So on a really practical level, like, how do you compose an email or pitch a show or come up with a book proposal while you're also devastated?
I love that you asked that question, because I always want to know, like, literally, but like, how did you do this thing? My agent, the woman who became my agent, had sent me just a condolence email. She was like, I read the obituary. It was really incredible. I'm thinking of you. And I replied and I said, thank you so much. And she said, you know, when in 5 or 10 years, when you want to write a book, like, be in touch. And I was like, oh, I want to write one now. And I told her I would get her a book proposal. And then I just sat and stared at my ceiling for weeks. And I went down to Arizona, where Erin's sister lives, and just sat and stared at her ceiling for weeks and did not do a book proposal at all. Didn't really sleep, drank a lot of white wine, watched a lot of Real Housewives. That was a good outlet for me emotionally. And then Jess sent me an example of a book proposal. And I was like, okay, that's helpful. And I attempted and sent it to her. And she was like, oh, my God, no. So she sort of helped me along with that. I think we went back and forth like a couple times. And then it was time to write it. And I was not sleeping at this time either. I would be unable to go to sleep. I would just stay up. I struggled so much. And when I finally sent a draft to Julia, my editor, she was like, I didn't hear from her for 2 weeks. And I was like, wow, I'm a perfect writer. And she did call and she was like, so this seems like this was really therapeutic for you to write. And
ouch.
And it's so great. You should, yeah. She's like, you should just keep it for yourself, like, or throw it away, either one. Oof. And Julia said to me, you wrote this like it's what you think someone wants to hear about a sad story. And I don't think you're a sad story. And I don't think you think Erin's a sad story. So why don't you write it like you're living it?
Coming up, Nora explains what it was like to grieve her husband while falling in love with another man. She also explains how she was terrified to be seen with that man in public.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Welcome back to The Cut on Tuesdays on Thursdays. I'm talking with Nora McInerney. author of the book No Happy Endings, and the host of the podcast Terrible, Thanks for Asking. In 2014, Nora's husband Aaron died of brain cancer. 5 days later, her dad died. A month after that, she had a miscarriage. And then a year later, she found herself falling in love again. I asked her about what that was like.
You mentioned being in love in your very first podcast episode with two men at the same time. And so tell our listeners a little bit about what you mean. Like, so you had Aaron in your life, and then you fell in love with a new person. Can you tell us about that story?
I met Matthew a year after Aaron died, and our first date was on the one-year anniversary of Aaron entering hospice, November 11th. And a year later, I'm sitting across the table from this sort of quiet, sweet guy with these giant blue eyes, and he's so visibly nervous, which Aaron never, literally never was nervous ever in his life, and definitely not around me. And I'm trying to have dinner, and I just keep thinking, like, a year ago I was writing Aaron's obituary. And I kept having to bring myself back to this present moment. But that tension existed immediately of, is it okay for me to feel these two things at once? And also that shame, like, what if someone sees me? What if someone sees me out here? Minneapolis is a small town. What if someone sees me at dinner with this guy? And it hasn't even been a year. It'll be a year in 2 weeks. And it feels like a magic number that people would like to see.
Mm. You were thinking that actually in the moment? What if somebody sees me?
Literally thinking that. I took the seat facing in, like facing into the restaurant versus out towards the busy street. Here's the thing. I was so afraid of it that on a different occasion, Matthew and I were out together and I did run into someone I knew, and Matthew and I were sitting at the bar facing the bar, and I turned away from him to talk to this person, and I kind of acted like I was just at this bar alone.
Wow. Did Matthew know that that's what was happening?
Oh, yeah. Yes, he did. He did. And he was like, I understand that.
Tell me about getting pregnant again with Matthew.
I have always taken pregnancy tests. I took pregnancy tests when I was still a virgin. Like, in high school, I was like, you know,
Just to be safe.
So I took a pregnancy test and I was like, oh my God. And I was so happy. And then I was just as instantly like afraid and ashamed. Those are the two main feelings that I had.
Why were you ashamed?
I was afraid that people would say, like, oh, good, like, she's pregnant. Oof, now it's over. You know, like, she got a guy, going to have another baby. You know, it's all over. And I was so afraid it would, like, invalidate, like, any sort of joy or newness would invalidate what I had with Aaron and what I felt for Aaron. And, oh, my God, like, what a fraud I am. Like,
you thought people would judge like you. Harshly.
Yeah, and I was judging myself, like, oh my God, really? Like, so now what? Now you're just happy? Now you're just gonna have another baby, a new baby?
But you were happy.
I was happy. I just couldn't, it just felt like stolen happiness. Like, I just like could not sit there with it. So now I have a different kind of shame, which is like, how dare you not just be happy about your happiness?
So how did you deal with that, with telling people about that pregnancy?
Poorly, very poorly. I didn't tell anybody, really. A couple friends, but I didn't put it on Instagram ever. And also, like, I don't know. I didn't want to tell anyone. I didn't want to have to explain it. And I didn't want to have to hear people say, like, oh, that's so great. Like, oh, what a happy ending. Oh, that's so,
So you are now a mother of two and a stepmother to two. Are they in the house with you, all of you guys?
Yes.
All together?
All of us, yes. We've got a four-pack.
How do you make time for, you know, your podcast, your books?
Yeah. Well, now I'm very scheduled with my time. So I have I'm basically just a big old freelancer. I have like a contract where I make this podcast. I write books. I have, you know, a nonprofit that I run, and they're all time consuming. Children are very time consuming, but I have my days really planned out. So I go to the gym every morning at 6 a.m. because otherwise I would not go. If I don't go at 6 a.m., I'm not going at 6 p.m. I come home, I go into my office, I shut the door, I write for 2 hours, and then I go to one of the offices that needs me. And on Thursdays, usually, I have blank space. So that's time for me to go to an appointment that I'd like to. It's time for me to like run a midweek errand. Hmm. And then also for me to just be home and not be on my phone and computer at night. I'm also really pushing back against all of this like constant work. I don't have email on my phone anymore.
Oh, that's a good hack.
Yeah, I'll just check my email. I'll check my email in the morning and I'll check my email in the afternoon. And like, otherwise, I guess if it's life and death, you'll call me, you know, but if it's a true priority, you'll dial a phone number. But like, we give ourselves all the time to the urgent at the expense of like the truly important.
Obviously, you interview a lot of people going through a lot of grief and loss. What advice would you give our listeners dealing with personal trauma or loss, you know,
Take your time with it. Like it will take you time even to not be okay, because at first when something bad happens and when death happens, sickness happens, like there's so much to do at first. There's so much to occupy you. You know, Aaron was diagnosed and I was like, okay, I can manage a chemo schedule. I can do this. I can do this. I can do this. And all of those things are important. You know, planning a funeral, that's important. All of these things give you purpose. And then it ends and it's so quiet, and it's really easy to try to rush through that part and to try to be okay so that you don't have to bum people out at brunch and to just get caught up in like the performance of okayness. And I think really the important thing is that you are doing this, whatever this is, for the first time. Every single loss, every single thing that happens to you is a first. It's the first time this specific thing has happened. So you might not know how to do it. You might not know what you need.
Is there a specific thing you might advise? Like you mentioned, you drank a lot. Are there any specific things you might tell people?
Oh my God, yeah. Take it easy on the booze. Yeah.
Thanks for joining us today on How I Get It Done.
Truly so excited to be here.
This episode was produced by Chris Neary and was edited by Lynn Levy. Mixing by Sam Baer. Our theme song is 9 to 5 by the one and only Dolly Parton. The Cut on Tuesdays is a production of Gimlet Media and The Cut. That's it for this week's show. We'll see you next Tuesday.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.